Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscawain is off today. What is it about politics that leaves some who hold public office susceptible to corruption? Thumb through news headlines of the past weeks, and there's Philadelphia's DA Seth Williams, charged with bribery, extortion, and fraud. He says he's not guilty. Former state treasurer Rob McCord is awaiting sentencing. He's pleaded guilty to attempted extortion, and a former city representative used the mayor's fund for Philadelphia as a personal slush fund, according to the city solicitor. Is corruption or the perception of it an inherent and even expected characteristic of state, local, and federal politics, or is this an erroneous perception? And what should efforts to prevent and weed out corruption in politics look like? What do you think? The number is to our comment line, 267-405-2006. You can text or call. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us to shed some light, Dave Davies, senior reporter for WHYY. Welcome back, Dave.
Good morning, Mary.
And Shane Creamer is executive director of the Philadelphia Board of Ethics. Hi, Shane.
Good morning, Mary.
So, you know, the biggest story of the past week or so is that of Philadelphia DA Seth Williams, indicted by a federal grand jury on 23 counts of bribery, extortion, and fraud. Williams allegedly sold his influence to help maintain an opulent lifestyle and, again, has pleaded not guilty. So Dave, first to you, the district attorney is Philadelphia's top prosecutor. What is it about this office that might make it vulnerable to corruption?
Well, I think, you know, before we get into that, Mary, I just want to mention one little thing in your intro. You mentioned the city solicitor had found that funds from the mayor's fund had been misused. It was the city controller, which is an independently elected official and not friendly to the mayor in charge of that. Just to make that little that little distinction. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know that the DA's office per se is any more inclined toward corruption than others. I mean, Lynn Abraham was there for 19 years without a whiff of it, and Ed Rendell served there for 8 years. I think any time people have power, there is a temptation to use that power for their own benefit, and you need laws and traditions and a strong media to kind of hold the check on that, and you need to elect good people. And I think in the case of Seth Williams, it seems clear that he got carried away with his own appetites and ambitions. I mean, it is remarkable to me that if one were going to do the things he is alleged to have done here in terms of, you know, getting expensive gifts from people and talking about dealing with cases. Now, he says he didn't blow out any cases, but he talked about things that were official, that he would do all this in electronic messages that live forever. I mean, here we are in 2017, and I think it's just a measure of the extent to which he felt comfortable, powerful, and entitled in the post.
Yeah. Shane Creamer, what do you think?
Well, I can't comment on the susceptibility of one particular office over any others. I agree with Dave. I don't think you can parse it out that way. But I think that power does have this influence over people. And I think you have to consider basic human nature as well. There's greed. You can't regulate greed completely out of human existence.
So this is the indictment of Mr. Williams is despite, Dave, what you call an ethical renaissance that has been happening in Philadelphia. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, this is a city with a long tradition of transactional politics and a lot of corruption and has a reputation for that. But over the last 10 or 12 years, we have seen a remarkable change both in laws passed. We now have campaign finance limits. There are none at the state level. We have a very, very tough anti-pay-to-pay law. No such law exists at the state level. And we have an ethics board. Shane Creamer on the line here with us is its executive director. And I don't know if people realize how busy they have been since about 2007 when they really got underway. And they have brought successful enforcement actions against the most powerful labor leader in the city, against judges, against Congress members, against council members. And I think it's had a huge impact in bringing a different kind of consciousness. You know, before, the only people that were really prosecuting corruption were federal prosecutors. And I've always said that's the nuclear weapon of ethics enforcement. These investigations take forever. They only go for really, really big cases. And what we've long needed was a body which made smaller, more frequent corrections to people's conduct. And over time, their perception of what they do changes. You know, if everybody's doing shady stuff around you, it starts to feel normal.
Yeah.
And I think what's happened over the last 10 years is that that stuff has begun to feel less normal because this board, just on the issue of campaign finance reports, has sanctioned dozens, if not hundreds of them. And I've spoken with Shane Creamer about this, and the indictment of Seth Williams actually breaks a streak, right, Shane? And I want you to talk about that.
Yeah, that's right. So we went for about 12 years without any city elected official being indicted. And that 12 years basically corresponds with the time that the Ethics Board has been around, from the beginning of the legislation that created it to today. And I think that easy to see a correlation there. I think that we have mandatory ethics training in addition to the campaign contribution limits that we have in Philadelphia that the state doesn't have, that Dave mentioned, and the pay-to-play law that Philadelphia has that the state doesn't have. Philadelphia also has a much stricter gift rule, and the state has a very lax gift rule by contrast. And I think those three things, the campaign contribution limits, the strict gift rule, and the pay-to-play law, plus mandatory ethics training and active enforcement by the board, has really changed the ethics landscape in Philadelphia over the past 10 years. And I think that's made a contribution to, as Dave said, you know, making small corrections. Yeah. I think that the city's stricter rules and enforcement act as circuit breakers that tend to lower the likelihood of criminal activity. And I think that there is a much higher awareness among elected officials and other top city employees and officials of the rules, and there's a much higher effort made towards complying with those rules.
So, Shane, give us a bit of an idea of the day-to-day operations of the Ethics Board. For instance, get into the mandatory ethics training. What does that involve?
So mandatory ethics training is annual training for elected officials and at a less frequent interval for other city employees.
What are they told?
Well, they're told about the ethics rules, which include the gift restriction, which I mentioned, the conflict of interest rules, financial disclosure requirements, limitations on representing people before city government, also the political activity rules, which apply to appointed officers, And so they get this training on an annual basis. We've already trained the mayor, the city controller, 10 city council members so far this year. We have 7 city council members scheduled for training next week. And we have the city commissioners. I think we're in the process of scheduling them as well. So, and this is not the first time each of them have been trained. So when you get this repeated training year after year, and we try to modify it and emphasize new changes. For example, we have a new gift rule in 2014. So that year and in 2015, we tended to emphasize the new gift rule.
Which is a limit of what, $99?
$99 mm-hmm. from sources who are seeking city action or whose financial interests the official can affect.
So, Shane, do you talk about penalties in this training? And what do those penalties look like? And do they need to be even tougher, in your opinion?
We do talk about the penalties. We don't emphasize them. It's geared towards compliance. And so we don't need to talk about the penalties that much, but we need to make them aware of them. We really talk about the substance of the rules, how they apply. We give them hypotheticals, and then we encourage them to ask for advice if they have questions. And our advice work has gone up dramatically in recent years. In FY16, we had 2,000 requests, just over 2,000 requests for advice, compared to 1,700 requests for advice in FY15. And if you go back further years, it's even less. So I think there's been a dramatic increase in requests for advice, and I think that's because there's a much greater awareness in Philadelphia among city officials and employees of the rules, and they need to get advice often on how to comply with those rules.
And I want to just throw in here that in addition to the training and advice, When they slip up, there are very firm reminders in terms of enforcement actions. And there are a couple I just want to mention. In 2007, in the mayor's race, highly contested mayor's race, in the closing days of the campaign, there were two anonymous flyers attacking Michael Nutter, one on a religious message, another on a racial message. This is an old tradition in Philadelphia politics. Anonymous flyers come out. They attack people. Nothing. They're printed by people. The printers are identified, but nobody says who paid for them, and nobody's ever tracked it down. And it just—it's this ugly little kind of part of Philadelphia politics. In this case, the ethics board went to the printer that had printed those flyers, got subpoenas, and after a long court fight, were able to get the most powerful labor union in the city, Local 98 of the Electricians Union, to admit that indeed their paid consultants had produced these flyers. Those and other violations led to a $10,000 civil penalty that the union paid. And since then, I don't think I've seen one anonymous flyer in the last 10 years.
So it's efficient.
That's a very specific way. Mm. They also, I remember when they had information that a councilwoman was using her staff for political purposes. They came in and essentially did a raid on the council office. So these are serious actions, and I think they have made a difference. Yeah. One thing that I want to mention before we lose Shane is I sometimes worry a bit that these penalties are frequent enough that they've sort of become part of the ecosphere, and politicians can pay them and move on. The most striking example is Blondell Reynolds Brown, the councilwoman in 2013, paid a, I think, $40,000 civil penalty for things like including depositing campaign checks into her personal account. Yeah. And 2 years later, she was endorsed by the party and happily reelected. Mm-hmm. I wonder, Shane, if you guys wonder whether this is becoming kind of tolerable, an acceptable cost of doing business for politics.
Do things need to change?
I don't think so when it comes to ethics and political activity violations. I think that may be more likely the case with campaign finance violations, where enforcement has become so routine with non-filers or omissions that it doesn't even make the news anymore. But having said that, I think that the enforcement of the campaign finance laws, as we have done, serves an important function because the public can be assured that the disclosure reports that we have electronically available on the board's website are complete and accurate. We have, in 2015, the last major municipal election, we had compliance rates in the cycles before the election of 97% during the 24-hour reporting period. It was 98%, and it was 98% for cycle three. And we're talking about thousands of unique filers for each of those cycles. So we have tremendous and tremendously high compliance rates, and we have people who are submitting complete and accurate reports, unlike what it was like before we were around. So I think that although those kinds of enforcement actions have become routine and cost of doing business, as critics often say, it has led to greater public disclosure.
Shane, I'm wondering if we can just keep you for a few minutes after the break.
Certainly.
All right. Shane Creamer is executive director of the city's Board of Ethics. Dave Davies along with us in studio, senior reporter for WHYY. And we'll be joined by John Baer, political columnist for the Daily News. We're talking about perceptions of corruption in politics, whether they're accurate, what's been changing in Philadelphia. We'll also take a look at what's happening on the state and federal levels after the break. And as always, if you'd like to join us, the comment line number, text or call 267-405-2006, or send us a tweet at WHYY. WHYY Radio Times. More is just ahead. You're listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowain. And this hour we're talking about, rightly or wrongly, that corruption is, a certain amount of it is inevitable in public office. We're talking about what's happening in the city of Philadelphia, an ethical renaissance, as WHYY's Dave Davies characterizes it. He's here with us in studio. We're also joined by Shane Creamer, who's head of the city's Board of Ethics. And also with us now, joining us, John Baer, political columnist for the Daily News. Hi, John, and welcome.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me. Hi, Dave. Hi, Shane.
Hey, John.
So I'd like to get to another story that's been making headlines recently, and this involves former Philadelphia City Representative Desiree Peterkin-Bell, who served in the Nutter administration and who chaired what's called the Mayor's Fund for Philadelphia. Dave, you want to get into what the fund does just a bit for us?
Yeah, this is a kind of a quasi-public source of money for beneficial things, which because it doesn't have the same controls that regular government funds do, has over the years been tapped for uses that are regarded as questionable. I mean, this has gone back for many decades. They've had a lot more money in the last few years because the funds from the Philadelphia Marathon, which turns out to be a big moneymaker, sure, have been deposited there. And what we've seen are news accounts and reviews by the city controller, Alan Butkovitz, who's not exactly a friend of Mayor Nutter, whose administration is at issue here, arguing that there are many, many tens and thousands, I guess hundreds, few hundred thousand dollars of expenditures in the fund which are not adequately accounted for.
I mean, Uber rides and reception.
A trip to Rome to plan the papal visit, which arguably was a useful thing for the city to do. And sure, you got a plan with the Vatican, and maybe it's better to use those funds rather than general fund taxpayer funds. But a strict accounting and efficient use is only a fair standard to employ. And the controller says there's too much stuff here that you just can't account for. Now, the mayor and the two directors of the fund, or two chairmen, past chair of the fund, Desiree Peterkin-Bell and Melanie Johnson, have said, well, they've said various things, but they've certainly not admitted to doing anything wrong about this.
But Butkovitz is asking, or he's asking that both the mayor and Peterkin-Bell come up with tens of thousands of dollars to replenish some of this money.
Right. And they're not prepared to do that.
No. And they've said that nothing awry has happened here. John, Mayor Nutter prided himself on running an ethical government, and now it's getting messier as he's lashing out at the fund's executive director, Ashley Del Bianco. What do you think about this story? And again, we're walking a line because I haven't seen the word corruption, but I have seen the words slush fund in association with this funny. This story, what is your take on this? And does this add to the perception that perhaps where there's money, people are tempted to do things or not keep track of things in a way that isn't proper?
Well, yes, Mary, to the last part of that. I mean, I think the public is now pre-pumped to believe just about anything about anybody, and you put the word politician, current, former, or aspiring, and money together, and you got your well. Then everybody does it. This particular story, I mean, I think Michael Nutter was a bit of some fresh air for Philadelphia over his term as mayor, and it's extraordinary to me. I mean, I never thought I would see the day when we out of Harrisburg would say, gee, Philadelphia is doing better than the state is as a whole in terms of aggressively going after things that go awry in politics. But the story doesn't grab me only because, A, Nutter's gone and is no longer of political interest, at least to me, and B, there does seem to be some gray area in there. As Dave pointed out, I mean, it kind of makes sense for city officials to be active and present in planning for a papal visit, for example. So, you know, given Nutter's record, given the scope of this thing, and given the animosity between Butkovitz and Nutter, I'm not sure it fits the total bill. And that's too bad because, as you suggest, I mean, I think from a public perspective, yeah, they're willing to believe that Nutter's in that whole crowd with everybody else.
You know, what I will say is that I do think that given this mayor's focus on integrity in government, those who served him should have been very careful to make sure that there was documentation for every dollar spent, and that clearly was not the case here. And another kind of slightly more subtle point, there's another player in the game. There's a city inspector general, which apparently, according to the Inquirer, conducted an investigation of this at some point and recommended the dismissal of Melanie Johnson, who was then involved, and that recommendation was not followed. And as it now stands, the inspector general, I'm pretty sure about this, Shane can correct me if I'm wrong about this, is appointed by the mayor. And it's a little hard for the mayor when information comes to him about people who he knows and have served him to be quite as tough as he might be if it were someone independent. And that's an argument perhaps for making the inspector general an independent position.
Shane Creamer, what do you think?
Well, I can confirm that the inspector general is appointed by the mayor. I can also say that our current inspector general, Amy Kurland, who has been the inspector general for about 10 years now, has made a tremendous effort to act as independently as possible, given the limitation of being essentially a deputy mayor. Beyond that, I really can't comment on any past conduct or investigations in this matter.
Yeah. Shane, what is the Ethics Board's role with something, an entity like the Mayor's Fund?
Well, I can just say generally, I can't say specifically about anything about the fund, but basically, the Ethics Board is an independent city agency. We have jurisdiction over the entire city government. That means all the independently elected offices, city council, the controller, the sheriff, the mayor's office, the administration, the DA's office. And so we enforce the ethics code, the conflict of interest rules, gift rules, disclosure rules, political activity restrictions, et cetera, that all apply to city officials. So wherever there's conduct by city officials that may violate the rules that we administer and enforce, we have jurisdiction to act.
Shane, I'd like to just get you to answer a tweet, if you would. Again, I'm not quite sure how much longer you have for it, but we've got a tweet from Jane who says, teaching ethics rules is not teaching ethics. We need both. What's the distinction there as you see it?
Well, I think that you need to change behavior, and I think that training does tend to change behavior. I think we're trying to give people a filter in their mind, if you will, to recognize issues. They don't have to become experts in the ethics rules and how they apply, but they do need to know when they have a potential question. And I think that we are changing the culture in Philadelphia. And I think I'd like to add, you know, there's another measure of how things have been different in Philadelphia in the last 10 years, and I think that's because of all the changes. And that's, if you go back to 2014, when council passed the new stricter gift rule, we had 17 co-sponsors of that bill. It was fast-tracked. It was quickly signed by the mayor. The board collaborated with city council on drafting it, and they wanted to get it right. And there was no crisis that inspired them or sort of compelled them politically to take that action at the time. I think they just wanted to improve the rules. And we've worked with them since on some other rule modifications, and we continue to do so to this day. So I think that that's another measure of how things are different. People understand in city council and elsewhere throughout government that these rules matter, and where the boundaries are makes a difference, and they want to make sure that we have the right boundaries set.
All right. Shane Creamer, Executive Director of Philadelphia's Board of Ethics, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Looking to the state level for just a moment, former State Treasurer Rob McCord, who pleaded guilty to attempted extortion. Let's get to that story. We do have an audio clip of McCord, so we're going to play this for you now.
I'm sorry. I let all of you down. The facts are these. I stepped over the line by trying to take advantage of the fact that two potential contributors hope to continue to do business with the Commonwealth, and by developing talking points to remind them that I could make things difficult for them. I essentially said that the potential contributors should not risk making an enemy of the state treasurer. Clearly, that was wrong. I was wrong.
Ouch.
So, all right, he resigned in 2015. He is awaiting sentencing. John, what is your take on the McCord case? And again, Dave and I were talking off mic how very different Philadelphia is from the state level when it comes to issues of corruption.
Yeah, it truly is, because at the state level, we have this sort of perfect hothouse of no rules and some rules that just allows this kind of stuff to grow and flourish. The McCord case, Mary, was a tough one. I think anyone who knew him and covered him over time was very surprised to see it unfold for two reasons. One, he kind of came up on his own and ended up with a Harvard degree and an MBA from Penn, was very smart, made a lot of money in the technology field, twice elected treasurer, running for governor, and early on in that campaign headed into the 2014 cycle was considered by many to be the favorite to be the next governor. And what you just heard on that clip you played is essentially saying, I'm a shakedown artist. I attempted extortion at least on two occasions. That's what he pleaded to interfere with the business of people that were doing business with the state unless they gave me a great deal of money. On a personal level, very disappointing, and on a public level, unsettling in the sense that it seemed to happen with such flow that it suggests that's the way things are done.
You know, he seemed to have everything going for him. So what would prompt him to take, we can't get into his head, obviously, only hear what we heard on the clip. But, you know, why take that risk?
Oh, I think we can get far enough into his head to know that it takes millions of dollars to run an effective statewide campaign for governor.
Yeah.
And you got to raise that in big chunks in a state which, in which, as John says, there are no limits on campaign contributions. So you have to be aggressive. And what's really fascinating, I mean, we saw just this week a dramatic development that he was testifying against someone accused of giving him $500,000 in campaign contributions in return for consideration on government contracts. Richard Ireland is his name. And the judge in the case stopped at midpoint and said, I'm sorry, the prosecution hasn't proved that there was a quid pro quo. You haven't proved that there was a deal. And I think this exemplifies the problem, right? It's usually not, I'll give you this for that. It's just understood. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you see $500,000 contributions or $250,000 contributions, people in the game kind of, you don't have to say that you're going to smile on me in the future. And I want to come back again to what, because this was the case in Philadelphia mayor's races in the past. You would see huge contributions from law firms, from insurance firms, from developers, and you don't anymore because in 2005, council passed this pay-to-play law, which says if you make a big contribution, you are disqualified from city work. And not just you, but your relatives, people in your firm. It's a really airtight law. So had Rob McCord been a candidate for mayor and had been on the phone with someone and asked for a big contribution, the person would have said, Rob, I legally can't even make that contribution. Let's not even talk about what you're going to give me for it because I can't make it.
And pay-to-play has been affected in Philadelphia in a big way. John, what do you think?
Yeah, it has. I mean, as I mentioned right at the start, whoever would have thought that, I mean, Philadelphia, outside of Philadelphia, has probably a far worse reputation than it now deserves. There's just no question about that. There has been real efforts and effective efforts to kind of change a culture that is very, very common in Pennsylvania politics, less so now, gratefully, in Philadelphia. The chances of that, of the same sort of standards being applied on a statewide level, however, remain, in my view, pretty dim.
Why is that?
There's just, the culture is so inbred. It's been in place for so long. I mean, the unlimited funding thing, people don't understand. We're one of a minority. There's only like a dozen states across the country. No other state in the Northeast allows unlimited campaign contributions. We have the most gerrymandered state in the Northeast, and one of the worst in the country. No other state just allows the political forces to shape the elections that we have. The incumbency rate of reelected members of the legislature is always 90% plus. The perks of office are so intense that once they're there, the structure of the state, again, because we have incumbent protections like no recall, no initiative, no term limits, no initiative and referendum, as I mentioned. We elect judges at all levels, so we bring in, we're only six states do that, and we're the only one in the Northeast. So that adds to the culture, brings the judiciary into the process. They all have to raise money, and for a statewide candidate, as Dave mentioned, you're talking about millions and millions of dollars, even in primaries these days, if you want to be in the game. And a lot of people want to be in the game, and the game is still rigged.
So at the end of the day, whose fault is that?
It's a long-term thing. I mean, it is the fault of people who are flawed, who get into a system that is flawed, and then make the best or the worst of it. I mean, the question you asked earlier, people have so much going for them. Why would they risk it? Because after they're in it a while, they believe themselves to be invincible, and they believe themselves to be a system that has worked for them and others for so long that they're untouchable, and so they just become a part of it. So it is And here's the thing, Mary. Let me just make this point because I think it's important. When journalism reports on corruption cases, there's a great level of fascination with the person or people involved, their friends, the details of the crimes, and then what happens to them. There is no fascination with the root causes, with the structural things that I've been mentioning, like the gerrymandering or the no term limits or the no initiative referendum, no recall, or the unlimited contributions. The process story won't get any attention. Mm-hmm. And so, particularly in a diverse, geographically large state like Pennsylvania, it's very tough to get a sustained interest in what actually sets the stage for the level of corruption that we see.
Does some of this, at least some fault at least, rest, Dave Davies, with John and Jane Q Public? In that, John, I know you asked in one of your articles, what have I done to make things better? I mean, Dave, what do you think? I mean, what can the average person who's frustrated, rolling their eyes at yet another political corruption story, the perception, whether it's federal, state, or local, that it's all around us, you know, what can we do to affect change?
You know, people are busy living their lives. I mean, they can pay more attention. They can get involved in politics. They can more carefully vet candidates. But I think that's hard, given what people face. A point I want to make, you know, I think that, you know, a lot of the things that John described were also true in Philadelphia when these reforms were passed after a corruption scandal. You know, we had no campaign limits here, and people, the incumbents were always elected. And I think one big difference between a city and a state, I've always felt that state capitals, they tend to be insular places. Legislators are there miles and miles from their districts, miles from their spouses, they get into trouble that way, and miles from their constituents. In City Council of Philadelphia, the constituents are only a bus token away. So when there was a scandal here in the early 2000s, and you had somebody like Michael Nutter and a couple of others who said, we have to change the rules, those 17 council members found it hard to say no, because their constituents just are closer. And I think people in legislatures, I don't know if you agree with this, John, I just think they're just farther from their local media, they're farther from their constituents, and it just enables them to kind of go their own way. Okay. There have been huge scandals and efforts for reform at the state, but they kind of dissipate.
You got about 10 seconds before the break, John. What do you think?
Dave's right. It's a great point. Capitals, many cases, were located in the central part of the state geographically so that everybody would have equal access. You don't really need to do that anymore. Maybe we ought to move to Philly, Dave.
All right, John Baer, political columnist for The Daily News. Dave Davies, senior reporter for WHYY. They're here through the top of the hour, so there's more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Dave Davies, senior reporter for WHYY, is in studio. John Baer, political columnist for The Daily News, is on the line. And we are talking about, rightly or wrongly, the perception that corruption is inevitable in politics. We're taking comments to our comment line. Text or call 267-405-2006. Our email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So let's get to one of those comments. Take a listen.
Hello, my name is David from Allentown, Pennsylvania. My question is it less the office that's susceptible to corruption, right, the type of office, and more the level of accountability that person has submitted themselves to up until that time? So saying it in a different way, if you're not accountable and you don't abide by some absolutes of accountability, then you are a person who is susceptible to corruption. And is it just that we find politicians are lacking that humility to submit to absolutes when it comes to accountability? I can do this. I can't do that.
John, what do you think? It sounds as if David is talking about the politician who perhaps makes themselves more available to scrutiny. Is this person less likely to find themselves ensnared in some sort of corruption scandal?
Yeah, Mary, I think that's a good point. I mean, a lot of this does go back to the individual, no matter what system you're in. This question about the office clearly has been disproven. I mean, we've had people been convicted or pleaded to crimes, from our Supreme Court justices to our Attorney General to our Treasurer to our lawmakers, House and Senate and mayors. I mean, go on and on and on. So it doesn't seem to be the office so much as the individual. And again, I mean, I think most politicians, humility is not a big factor in the lives of most politicians. They wouldn't be running and saying that they can run things if they were humble. But accountability ought to be. And if the caller is trying to say that, a humble person is more accountable, I think that's correct. And again, as I mentioned earlier, I think that once you're in the system and the longer you're in the system, and you can see there really aren't, in the case of statewide office anyway, a lot of reins on what you do and how you do it. If you're inclined that way, you're going to run.
Let's get back to Philadelphia for a moment. John, in one of your articles, you say, build a semblance of a GOP in Philadelphia. And Dave, you and I were talking about this a little bit, too. I guess if you have a mostly Democratic town, then most people who go, off the rails will be Democrat. Law of averages here. So how might encouraging the growth of another party help?
You asking me or Dave?
Oh, you first.
Okay. I think it wouldn't matter which party was running one thing or another. I think it's always dangerous to have too much of one party in any process, whether it's an electoral process or a policy process. People ought to have a choice. Elections ought to have different viewpoints. And we don't have that in Philadelphia. If you look at the 2016 elections, I think two-thirds of the legislative offices that were up for re-election in Philadelphia had no opponents, many of them not in the primary, not in the general. So, I mean, that's not democracy. That's just rubber stamping what we've already got. If the Republican Party could find a way to get a point of view across in an aggressive and consistent and sustained message, I think they can make some cases, particularly in certain sections of the city. And so that's what I meant by encouraging some semblance of a GOP.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I do think that there's sort of a new leadership crew in the Republican Party the last few years, and they are really trying to make a case for what they call an urban Republican politics, which is maybe not quite Donald Trump politics, but something that is socially liberal but fiscally conservative. I mean, the thing about it is, I do think that it's not like there isn't competition in Philadelphia elections. I mean, there's not partisan competition, but there are plenty of fights and factions within the Democratic Party. So when there's an election that matters, like for mayor in 2007, you had a whole bunch of different high-profile politicians raising money and fighting for votes. I'll also note that when Republicans have gotten some power in Philadelphia, they haven't looked all that different. John Purcell, the Republican Speaker of the House from Philadelphia, was hauled away on corruption charges. And when he helped engineer a takeover of the Philadelphia Parking Authority a few years back, and it became largely a Republican patronage haven, it wasn't exactly a model of integrity. I mean, contracts went to friends and contributors, jobs went to ward leaders and committee people, and we've had all these stories lately about, excessive executive compensation and sexual harassment.
Let's talk about ethics in a case like the Parking Authority and Vince Fenerty, who resigned, over sexual harassment complaints. He's pulling quite a pension. And I did see, in reading up for this show, there were questions about ethically, why does this sort of thing happen? And he's not a felon, but, why do felons continue to, pull, feed at the city trough? I mean, what needs to happen there to change this? And if we don't have Shane Creamer with us anymore, but I'm wondering if you know offhand how the ethics board,
Well, in part, there's a little bit of a technical answer. The Parking Authority is technically not a city government institution.
Yeah.
It is a state authority. It is created by the legislature, and therefore, the regular city ethics rules don't apply there. And it was created that way by Democrats. Let's just be very clear about this. I mean, for many, many years, this was a Democratic patronage haven, and there's a pretty strong stench coming out of there, too. Some awful stuff happened because it was the one little playpen where politicians could reward their friends, ward leaders, contributors, and supporters with jobs and contracts. So that's an old tradition there, and I think it's just been sort of tolerated more than it should. I mean, there should be, the city controller or the state auditor general ought to be able to go in there and clean house, but we'll see if that happens.
John, any thoughts?
Yeah, just on the pension stuff, Mary, that thing, according to my email and phone calls, really irks people and ticks people off when we see public officials going away to prison or making pleas and to make deals and retaining their pensions, whether they're felons or not. Just in the sake of public perception and public life, we ought to find a way to look. If you're convicted of a crime, you plead to a crime, and it's a felony, you lose your pension. And in fact, I would bake into any public office, whether no matter the crime. I mean, if you commit a crime on public time, you shouldn't be entitled to have the public pay, you know, a pension to you for the rest of your life. That really annoys people, particularly as we've seen in the last decade or so, pension systems go down the drain all over the place, whereas public pensions continue to be, you know, as big and generous as they've always been.
So let's get back to perception for a moment, because we were talking about the ethical renaissance, and there's real hard, clear-cut evidence that this is happening in Philadelphia. And yet, when you have a story, you know, like Fenerty and the Parking Authority, which is a state-created entity, you know, still pulling a heck of a lot of money from the PPA, even though he's gone, when you have, you know, and of course, Congressman Shaka Fatah, who, you know, has you know, serving, a 10-year prison sentence, and that's on the federal level. But how do you work to really dispel, I guess, this impression that people have that, oh, you know.
Well, you know, I mean.
It's inherent.
Look, I mean, it's Shaka Fatah, the congressman. There's a number of state legislators and the people at the Parking Authority, and they are Philadelphians. So let's not, I'm not going to suggest for a minute that Philadelphia's politics are all now squeaky clean. Technically,
but
those
isn't
are,
it important
state
for people to know that things are moving in the
it
right
is.
Direction, at least in your in
it
your
is.
Opinion,
and,
Dave?
It is, and I do think it is ironic that kind of that the perception among players in city politics has changed, because they know that the ethics board watches, and if you file a campaign finance report with all sorts of funky, screwy holes in it, it's going to get scrutinized, and you're going to be held to account. They know that, but the public doesn't. I mean, there is also just the fundamental problem of media reporting, which is that we report on crashes, disasters, indictments, and murders. You know, think somebody who goes to their job every day and does a terrific job for taxpayers is not a story most of the time. And so I fear that we sometimes create the impression that everybody is corrupt. And I have known countless people in covering government who are there for the right reasons and try to do it well. I'm not quite sure what the answer to that is, but I do think it's something to bear in mind.
John Baer, are we in the media at least partly to blame?
Well, you know how we roll. we go with what, if it bleeds, it leads, and all of that. Yeah, I mean, Dave's point is a valid one. There are tons of people in state government and many, many, many state lawmakers who are in public life for the right reason and trying to do the right things and serving their constituents and staying on the right side of the law. But that's not news. You know, good news is no news. So, I mean, the media is doing as much as it can at a time when resources are down and limited, and news is boiling aplenty. It's hard to keep up. But there's no question we shape perception still, and the perception remains pretty bad, and in many cases, for very good reasons.
And one thing I try and remind myself is that you want to shine a light when people are trying to change things. I mean, there is, for example, this movement Fair Districts PA, which is a serious effort to change the way we draw political boundaries in this state, both for congressional and state legislative districts. John's written columns about it. I've done stories on it. And it does seem to be a movement. Maybe it's a long shot, but it has some energy behind it. And so I think we need to also make it clear sometimes that there are alternatives and people who work hard for them.
Is it gaining some sort of traction? Fair District PA, I think.
Well, I went to an event they had in Montgomery County at which 600 people showed up to hear a slideshow about how political districts are drawn. So they're certainly getting some attention. Now, whether
is this in the wake of the 2016?
Yeah, I think partly it is a reaction to progressives who are appalled by what happened in the presidential race. But the fact is, it's connecting at some level. And the interesting question will be, you know, when it gets down to votes in the legislature, will there be enough kind of juice to make something happen? And that's where I turn to my friend John.
Well, Mary, first let me say, and Dave has probably seen this too, since the 2016 election, there's been an enormous uptick in just sort of not just grassroots activism, but citizen interest in government at all levels. I've been doing this a long time, as has Dave. I have never received as many personal emails and personal phone calls from average readers who either had questions or comments on a whole variety of things, not just high-profile issues, but on things like fair districts that Dave mentioned, a very active and aggressive group, and they're still at it. They're going all the way around the state. There's another younger group, March on Harrisburg, that is planning. They're doing citizen lobbying days leading up to a big march that they plan in May or June out of Philadelphia, looking for reform issues, pushing reform issues. These things have always been around, these efforts, but I've never seen them at a level of intensity. The question I have is, can they be sustained? Yeah. Because when it comes to Harrisburg, they're going to hit a brick wall, especially now, because if you go and talk to legislative leaders about any kind of reform issues, they say, well, we can't deal with it now. We have a budget deficit. We got to deal with the deficit and serve the state's fiscal needs and blah, 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 which is always the out. So it'll be interesting to see what happens May, June, when these activist individuals and groups push for some resolution and are blockaded.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, so we've got time to get one more comment in from our comment. Well, okay, I'm told that we'll have that in just a couple of seconds, but I'd like to get to at least one or two of our emails or texts. We've got one from Eric, an email. The generosity of the city's pensions, there we go with the pensions, is so out of line with what the general public receives, but how can this ever be expected to change since voting to change these benefits involves a conflict of interest? Thoughts, Dave Davies?
Well, I will just note that, city pensions are generous, but they often accompany salaries that aren't so generous, and that's been the trade-off over the years. But no, I mean, taxpayers have to pay the bill, and they have to be managed in a fiscally responsible way. Lawmakers get those same pensions, so yes, in a way, maybe it is a conflict. Although most of the people who are actually casting the votes are so far into their careers, they're not going to have a great financial stake in changes for the future. Mm-hmm. I just think there are other interest groups, including unions, that have a strong voice in this stuff. And, you know, like so many things that we see at the local, state, and national level, I mean, people need to come together around reasonable solutions, and I think they can be found, but it's tough.
All right, let's get to that comment now.
This is Lauren from Philadelphia, and my comment relates to the idea of Citizens United impacting our local municipal elections as opposed to the state elections where there are no campaign finance limits. I'm interested to hear what everybody's thoughts are moving forward of how much dark money is coming into city politics and how that's going to impact behavior on the ground.
And we thank Lauren for that comment. John Baer, what do you think?
I don't think it does it, Dave? I mean, aren't there still the limits apply under the Home Rule Charter to Philly's own
actually,
rules?
No, I mean, they aren't charter restrictions. They're city ordinances. And in fact, in the last mayor's race, we saw a ton of independent expenditures, the kind that were permitted by Citizens United. They were two-thirds of the spending in the mayor's race. So I think Lauren is right to be concerned about this. I will draw a distinction between independent expenditures and dark money. Dark money means using subterfuges to hide contributors. By far, most of the money that went into the mayor's race, the contributors were ultimately reported. But I think it is a serious issue, and I will just make one quick point. I know we're short of time. The City Ethics Board has established much tougher rules than the Federal Election Commission for reporting on it, for policing coordination between the candidates supported and the independent group that is supporting them. But it's no doubt a challenge to the limits here, and it's going to be something we're going to have to deal with.
All right, I want to quickly get one more comment in. Susan asks, the history of corruption in Philadelphia city government perhaps is one of the reasons that Harrisburg is so resistant to spending on Philadelphia schools. Quickly, John Baer?
No question. Anytime you talk to a conservative, particularly a conservative lawmaker who has a handle on the appropriations process, that is one of the first things they'll say. Philadelphia has to get its own house in order. There have been a lot of problems in the school districts, been a lot of problems in the politics. We're disappointed in that. Until they take care of their own house, we're not interested in taking care of it for them.
All right. And on that note, we've got to wrap it up. John Baer, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
Mary, thanks for having me.
And John is a political columnist for The Daily News. And Dave Davies, as always, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with
studio.
You, Mary.
All right. Dave is senior reporter for WHYY. Remember, check out our Facebook page and give a listen to our podcasts. You'll find them at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producer is Debbie Builder, John Ahrens. and Trinae Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in today for Marty Moskowain. Great to have you along for Radio Times.